Hey everybody, this is Telling Mental Health, where we break stigma with story.
Each episode, we feature a true and personal mental health related story, followed by a conversation with the storyteller.
We are your hosts. I'm Erica Blumfield.
And I'm Scott Randall. And today's story comes from Sean Ewart.
I know what it's like to not have a friend in the world. We moved a lot because of my mother's mental illness. I went to 5 different elementary schools. I am really good at being the new kid. All those moves catch up with me, and I end up friendless in the 7th grade. I'm 13, sweaty, stinky, and with huge curly hair. In an attempt to make friends, I decide to audition for a musical. My name is called, I walk to my spot, the piano starts, and I sing Happy Birthday. Then silence. And from where I'm standing, I can only see a tight bun of gray hair. Finally, the lady says, "You can't sing. You'll never be able to sing." Ugh. So defeated, I go home. Now, luckily for me, they don't have enough males. And the wall phone in the kitchen rings later that night, and I have the part. I will be playing the king in The Princess and the Magic Pea. But I have to sing a song. And the problem is, I've never been in a play before, and I don't know how to sing, and my voice is changing daily. I think about asking my mother for some help. However, we made a very grown-up agreement that when I was in the 1st grade, I would be responsible for all my own homework. She made it clear that her mental illness was not going to let her help me. Ugh. But I approach her anyway because I am desperate. Like a Hollywood agent deciding whether to take a new actor on, my mother mulls over my casting situation. She sizes me up across the kitchen table. She adjusts the pale pink fuzzy bathrobe she never takes off. She twists her long black hair. She looks through her piles of paper as if she's checking her calendar. "Fine," she says. "I'll do it." "Do what?" I ask. "I'll coach you," she replies. "Well, how?" I ask. "I'll teach you how to sing and act. I know what I'm doing," she says. "But, I'm scared to go on stage, and what if I forget my lines or nothing comes out of me?" I ask. She says, "It's all part of performing. It can all fall apart, but that's the risk. You could be bad, but it's not a reason not to try. More often than not, you'll be good, I assure you." Then, my mother takes my hands and asks, "Can I please do this for you? It's the only thing I have to give you." I am totally taken by surprise. This feeling, she really wants to help me. I feel for the first time what it's like to have my mother engaged in my life. I'm so giddy. "Yes, yes, yes, please help me," I say. So, my mother uses her hand to show me that when you sing, that notes go up and notes go down, because clearly I hadn't figured that out. So with her hand, she sings, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound." I try to copy her, but I can't do any of it because my voice cracks and breaks and hisses like a car radiator. But my mother, the pro, she solves it. I will speak all of my song lyrics. So it's opening night of The Princess and the Magic Pea. Oh my gosh, I am so, so nervous. I'm peeking through the curtain to see if my mother's in the audience, and she's not. But then I see a pair of huge Jackie O sunglasses slip in through the back of the auditorium. Like a missing cast member from a James Bond film, my mother stealthily scopes out her spot, where she can simultaneously watch and escape at the same time. Black hair tied back, trench coat collar up, my mother holds her program to her face, shielding herself, keeping the voices inside and at bay. Now, I'm dressed in a black catsuit, which looks like something Bob Mackie designed. And I speak sing like Rex Harrison about the virtues of my princess daughter. My crown stays on, and I'm loud. I'm so loud, you can hear me outside. And after the show, I'm just mobbed by the senior citizens. They say I'm the only actor they can hear. I'm a triumph. So over the sea of gray heads by the auditorium, I look and I say, "Where's my mother?" And I can't find her. She has escaped. But I know she's proud of me because she tells me so later at home. My mother gives me the only gift she has, how to act like someone else. And I get really good at it. By the time I graduate high school, I've been voted the most talented in my class. I even sing a song at my graduation. But my mother doesn't come to hear me sing in front of my largest audience ever, 3,000 people. The voices in her head win that year, and I begin to lose her piece by piece. My mother was right. Acting, singing, performing in front of people, it's all a risk, and it can fall apart at any moment, but that's the fun, right? However, more often than not, you'll be good, and everyone will love you.
And now we're here with Sean Ewart to talk about that story. Welcome to the podcast, Sean.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So good to see you, Sean. One of my favorite storytellers in LA and Chicago, out of Chicago too, right?
Yes.
Yes. So grateful that you're here.
One of the first things I noticed in the story was the moving around a lot. And I can relate to that because I was in four different schools overall through K through 12 from California to Texas, but you five different schools in elementary school or five different, how did that affect you as a kid growing up before you get to seventh grade where this story takes place?
So I got to tell you, so my mother's issues were so vast and deep and dare I say squirrely. That my father didn't actually know what he had married into until after I was born. So my mother hid things really well, which is not uncommon. You know, she was holding things together. I don't think anyone realized how dark she actually was until much later in her life. But we had to do weird things to our homes in all these neighborhoods so my mother could sleep, because sleep was the big problem. Like this sort of balance between daytime, nighttime with my mother was really bad. She would get these tirades and this mania. So we did crazy things to our houses. You know, she wanted extra walls in her bedroom so it would be quieter. If a dog was barking down the street, it would drive her up the wall. And we kept losing our equity in all of our homes because she would decide on a dime that we had to move. So the collateral damage, of course, is me. They just kept pulling me out of neighborhood and school over and over and over again. So when I say that in the story, I know I kind of make it light and sort of, but the reality was I kept having to start over. And when you're an adult, we're all adults. My mother would just settle into her new home and get her like, you know, crazy world set up and try to manage her life in that house. And then I'm literally in an entirely, you know, a different age, right? 5, 7, 9, whatever. So it wasn't until later that I realized how many schools I went to, but the reason wasn't just because we wanted to get a new house. It's because my mother literally on a dime changed.
I'm curious, I have a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. So did she have a particular diagnosis?
So it's such a good question. And you know, she's from the manic depressive years, right? So it wasn't bipolar yet. And there was not as much known as there is now. She was raised first Jewish a little bit, and then it transferred to Catholicism because they became crypto Catholics. They were Jewish at home and Catholic to the world. So she was already kind of messed up with different doctrines going on at home because she was younger than everybody else. So in the 50s, she said she was 13 years old. She's like, "I think there's something wrong with me." And her parents took her to a priest. But the priest was part of the problem, religion and so on.
So that delayed any diagnosis, plus there just really wasn't anything. So that was a long answer to your question. I don't think so. She would not go into, she fought going into any sort of treatment. So it got really sketchy. She got some sort of diagnosis late in life. And frankly, I think there was some multiple personality thing going on, or a schizoid diagnosis of some sort. But to answer your question, it's very fringy. Whatever it is, it's this horrible crisscross of like massive OCD and bipolar with a little schizoid around the edge. Mm-hmm. Some of the folks said she was by far one of the most complicated people they've ever met.
Wow. Yeah.
And I mean, as a child, you're growing up and meeting adults and learning about the world. So maybe at an early age, you didn't notice that anything was a little different. And was there a certain age where you did notice something was different about your mom versus other parents, or about the concept of mental health in general?
Yeah, it's crazy that you asked that question. So my mother told me as a 7-year-old that she was going to kill herself. And this was so ingrained into my upbringing that I was extremely blasé about it. She's like, you know, if I ever kill myself, it's not your fault. And now, you know, as a full grown adult, I mean, how sweet is that to try to prepare your child for something terrible, you know, but like I'm 7. I'm sorry. It's just kind of funny. I mean, it's not funny, but I mean, it's ludicrous.
I mean, it's a sweet thought in her own way. She was trying to be sweet about it.
Yeah. Well, that's what I find. So, I mean, the first time I heard your story, I was just so blown away at the level of love that I feel coming through it for your mother, despite how hard your life was because of her illness. Mm-hmm. And I think that it made me think of the conversation, like there's these moments where she's just totally present. And it shows how strong her love was for you. But in a moment like that in the story, when she explains that her mental illness was not going to let her help you, do you remember that conversation? Like, do you remember? I mean, it's so lucid, like it's so clear.
And it's like detached. It's like she would like to help you, but her mental illness won't let that happen.
Yeah, she made it very clear. In fact, I remember my mother and I used to call it crying at midnight because I was a terrible student. We didn't have a television for years. And when it broke, we just didn't replace it because my grades were so bad. This is in the 70s. And I would be in my bedroom by myself, like sobbing over some, you know, terrible new math or some horrible 70s thing. And I'm like, could you help me? And she's like, I don't know how to do that. Like she couldn't do my like first, second or third grade stuff. Mm-hmm. And I do remember in the moment, it felt weird. It's like a parent shouldn't be like leaving you. Like she was always leaving me. So there's this standoff. She stood off to try to help me. Like the less she engaged, I think she felt the more she was helping.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, like almost staying away is better than being present. And that's got to be hard on a parent, mm-hmm. feeling like you yourself are a bad influence on your kid. And then you feel guilty about it. Yeah.
This may sound weird, but I think that there's something about no matter how much your mental illness is activated, I think for so many people, they still understand that like a child's involved, mm-hmm. you know, like that, like it breaks through the madness somehow. Like she wanted to protect you. She wanted to protect you from the reality of that she would maybe take her life. I don't know. It's just, did it take you time to kind of come to this place where you emanate so much like love for her, despite how hard it may have been?
Yeah, actually. Well, she took her life in 2015. And I'm actually completing an hour show for Storysalon. I was invited to do a work in progress thing. So I actually just wrote a piece today, a connector piece. I had a bunch of stories and I had something I just threw in there. And I was like, oh, that doesn't feel right. When she took her life in 2015, my dad called. No, it wasn't my dad. Sorry. The coroner called and left me a voicemail. And I thought it was a joke. So I called them back and we figured it out. It actually sounded like it was a murder suicide because of the way they said it. They said both my parents, not just my mom. And then my dad later told me that she didn't want to kill him. So she was having some issues with keeping him safe. When she was finally gone, I know this is going to sound really weird, but I was so relieved. And so was my dad. My dad was just run ragged for like 50 years with her. And with him not suffering as much because she'd gone down to 80 pounds. She hadn't showered in 5 years. My dad had to take like scissors or a saw or something and cut her hair. That's how like bad it got. It was really, really bad. So going through the house and helping my dad, and I've moved back home to be closer to my father and so on. I have reached that forgiveness place because I've been so involved in the cleanup afterwards. She did it at home. I found the bullet hole in the house. The police couldn't find it. I don't know why. They couldn't find a suicide note or a bullet hole. And I found both. I was like, who are these people? Sorry, that was kind of not your question. But yes, part of the care of my father and knowing that she was wanting this so much, like really, really wanting to leave, to know that she's out of pain is other people be like, no, she should stay. She needs to work. She needs to get better. There was no future for her. It was not going well. She had no friends. She hadn't worked a day in her life. It was very, very rough. So it was a long answer, but she, there's peace. I feel peace. I mean, she must feel peace. I feel peace. Right. I mean, she did it right. And she left. She made a decision.
Yes.
And you mentioned that she hadn't been working and yet she has this lesson to share with you in the story about acting. And I don't know if you had seen her as an actor or suddenly picked up on her kind of telling you that this has been a performance, or she feels like she consistently has to perform in different aspects of life. I just thought that was really sweet that you tackled this moment of her being able to give back after not being able to, and how there's almost like a superpower in there somewhere that she's been practicing for this her whole life. Did she see herself as an actor most days? And did you see herself as an actor after that?
Yeah, both my parents were actors before they met. My dad was actually scouted out by the Pasadena Playhouse in the 50s, because he went to PCC and he was scouted out by all the Shakespeare ladies. And my dad was stunning, by the way. He looked like Steve McQueen. I mean, he was hotter than hell. In the 40s, my grandmother was also stunning. They were stopped on the street all the time to go to the studios because they would just pull people off the street in the 40s. And my grandmother was a nurse. She was super sensible. She's like, absolutely not. Which sucks. But my mother also had a similar background. She was really stunning. They both were, you know, good singers and so on. And, you know, late 60s, people just got married and had kids and didn't finish school and all just kind of fell apart. But yes, it was definitely her way of coping. My parents were both very theatrical around the house. You know, I love your question because it just made me think of something. The reason why I wrote this piece is there was a perfect moment that had happened, which was I had some talent and I wanted to go audition for a play and I didn't have any friends. And it just happened to be the thing. My mom encouraged me and it was the one, it's like it aligned, like everything wasn't aligning. And suddenly, oh, I can help. Oh, Sean wants to go do something. This is the one thing I can coach him on. And I know it's a little magical in the story, but it literally was two worlds finally clicking for just a moment. And then it kept going on. You know, she got me going just enough to do it. I think there was some lost love in life for her in that she got enjoyed me doing it. It's a shame. You know, if my mother wasn't living with mental illness, she would have been a whip smart. She would have been a real estate broker or some CEO or something. And I think you both know, I mean, some of the most mentally ill people I know are the smartest. They're living with this. Go ahead.
Oh, it takes a lot of brain power, I think, to be able to live with a mental illness. You know, you're dealing with so many different
realities.
Yeah. Realities. Yeah.
Yes.
I know about that, but yes. I think that it also speaks to, without treatment, I don't know how much she wouldn't take meds or what was right. And therapy and things like that, but really without meds, it's really hard to control. And it's so debilitating. It's just so debilitating. But I think that, like, even if she had mental illness, when she has mental illness, like, the good thing is that there's progress, there's better meds, even though meds are so complicated. And it's just sad, right? Because it doesn't work for everyone anyway, but how you can have mental illness and still do stuff if there's treatment involved. I don't know, it just really struck me. And I think and it really moves me that your father stuck by her all those years. I mean, take it from someone who's been like mad as a hatter. It's terrifying out there when your mind is like that. So,
yeah. You know, my dad, it's so interesting you said that. So he only had a couple choices. You know, he could divorce her and let her just roam the streets, because that's what would have happened. I mean, as it was, she was wandering around, and my dad leaks little stories here and there. He's like, oh, we used to go there. And he would stop. I'm like, there for what? Like, I don't know if she had practiced suicide things going on, or she went off to go do it and, you know, changed her mind. He went back and picked her up from wherever. But there's a whole life going on that I don't know about, because I left here. I left home in 91, and then I only saw my parents like five times over the next 25 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. But he had a couple choices, right? He could make it safe for her until she finally expired, or he could just leave. Like, those were his two choices. And she had her own credit card because she was a compulsive shopper, and she had, you know, kind of a mini hoarder, not a big hoarder, a little hoarder. And she would have some shopping that was extreme, not enough to bankrupt someone, but too much shopping. And he just managed it. He gave her a card. He managed her at the house. He went and got things and brought back. He made it so she didn't have to leave her cocoon. But at what cost? You know, I mean, I couldn't do it.
I don't think most people can do it. That's what people don't understand when they pass a homeless person on the street who's probably mentally ill. It's really hard on the family. There aren't mm-hmm. ways always to reach someone, but mm-hmm. that your mom, you're saying your mom literally would have been homeless wandering the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't have money to care for. There's so many reasons. Anyway, wow. Wow, wow, wow. Scott.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I mean, yeah, there must have been some rewarding aspects to it, of, you know, living with someone and them needing your help, and I don't know, learning from that kind of vulnerability for another person to have. And I mean, just like she taught you the lessons of performance, were there other lessons that you felt like you gained growing up in that household that maybe your friends weren't getting?
Well, my parents were raging liberals, raging liberals. I mean, my father is way, way more liberal than I am, I think. I mean, I am, but he's out there. And I mean, when I came out of the closet, they were both pretty cool. My dad has never been upset. My dad was fine. He didn't bat an eye. My mother had a little bit of a problem. And, you know, now that she's passed, I actually feel comfortable saying this, but when I told her I was gay, she said, I thought you were hot for me. And I got to tell you, I still think about that. This happened like 30 years ago. I thought about that in the moment. And I was like, she'd made it about herself. Which I have to laugh because, I mean, you know, here I am in my big, big moment, right? My big life thing. And she's not upset, but she just turned it inward. And I was like, this just doesn't sound right. So I guess where I'm going with that is their overall accepting thing. I actually turned her around to like a total P-flag mom. I mean, she was like friending gay people on the phone, and like every salesperson she talked to, you know, she ordered stuff and returned it all the time. And she was talking to some woman on the West Coast, and she's like, blah, blah, blah. And the woman says, yeah, well, me and my partner, blah, blah, blah. And she goes, oh, she's like, my son is gay. This is in the 90s. And the woman on the phone goes, hi, mom. So she had her own growth going, right? Despite all the mental illness going on, she had grown as a gay mom, right? They were super liberal and wickedly funny. Like, and, you know, again, I think her mental illness just made her even funnier. I mean, just because she was forced to, you know, find the funny, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, humor. I'm trying to think of it. That's a really good question. You know, they're very odd. My parents were my dad's still alive. They were a little odd and a little off. And my mother, without my father and me, she wouldn't have had as good a ride as she had. It wasn't the best, but like, we were just weird enough that things could be said, and we kind of went, oh, that's pretty horrible. And we just kind of truck along. One thing I wanted to add to that was really good, and it went out of my head. Oh, so here's the other thing. My parents were both introverts. So even though they were performers, they're introverts. And my grandmother, who I traveled the world with and stuff, she was an extrovert. And my parents gave birth to me, a massive extrovert. And Erica, back to what you were saying, like the stress of the family. Now that I'm older, how stressful it was for her, my mother, to have this horribly extroverted, social, craving people child. What's that like?
I don't think you were a problem. You sound like you were wonderful.
But like for her to show up to things, she didn't go to PTA meetings. Yeah. I didn't go to Boy Scouts. I couldn't have friends over. Like, all I did was bug her to go be normal. And she's like, no, no, no. I mean, that's hard on her.
That right? brings, yeah, that part in your story is so powerful. And that she walks in with the Jackie O sunglasses and like, she's so glamorous, even, you know, and incognito in the most perfect way, especially for a dramatic woman. I always choose the Jackie O sunglasses too. It's always a great way to go. I love you reference Bob Mackey too.
I have a picture of it somewhere. I'm not, no joke. It's like I'm wearing a woman's, like, it looks like a Carol Burnett like costume from her show.
Right, because he did the Scarlett O'Hara curtain mm-hmm. rod one, and he also did like Cher's amazing. Was that mm-hmm. the Oscars? The one that was like she or like, and it had like a head. It was just yeah. Anyway, yeah. I like those details in your story.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. But yeah, just the moment that, she showed up again, or that how hard it was for her to go to things. And that night, man, she was there.
Mm-hmm. I added a line. I don't know if it's in this, you know, if I did it in this story or if I'm doing it going forward, but I've mirrored singing at the end of the story at my graduation with singing to the senior citizens when I'm younger. And I added, just like when I'm 13, I'm looking for her again and she's not there. And it's a line I didn't have in a while ago. And it's that this was a happy accident. I'm like, oh my gosh, it totally repeated itself. Like the same thing happened, but she doesn't show up the second time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, she didn't see me graduate high school.
Ugh.
That's terrible.
It's sad. It's sad on so many levels. I thank you. I'm getting emotional. Oh my God. Because I feel like, I don't want to say most times, but frequently when I hear people who had parents who were or are mentally ill, it's coming and they're entitled to whatever they're feeling, like anger or disgust or horrification or whatever it is. But I sit in the audience and I think like, oh boy, like, oh boy, like, they didn't mean it. I know, or not to make excuse. I don't really know how to articulate it, but that's because I feel like, and especially in this conversation, like you don't shy away from like the harsh reality of what it's like, but then you offer this really like compassionate aspect of it. And so I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure. I mean, she's a very sweet woman. She was very much like a child. She's very childish in a lot. She's sort of like a 12-year-old that just never grew up.
Yeah, it was almost like she wanted to be in the play, you know, and yeah. She was able to live that through you, which was fun, and as if you were classmates or.
Yeah, totally.
I'm excited. We have to release this episode maybe soon so that because we can talk about, we're going to be on that show together. Is this you're going to be telling the story or along? Yeah. So people will be able to come see you in action live, which is such a treat.
Absolutely. I saw the call for that. And I actually had prepared for you, and I was like, oh, well, this is like such a great fit. So I sent it in and they accepted me. So I was really excited that I got to share this. It's such a good fit for the mission of that show. So that's going to be good. I'm really glad you're doing this podcast. I feel like people think that they talk about mental illness a lot, but until truly the suicide part, just put the cap on the whole thing. Until you've had suicide in your life, you don't know what it's like to have suicide in your life. And I truly say that because I didn't. And then I'm like, oh, I remember when it happened. I'm like, oh, I'm now in, right? I'm part of it. I know it. I'm part of the family of people that have lost someone. And then I didn't realize until she died how long I had been dragging so much of her pain for decades, decades and decades and decades. And there's a little PTSD. My father and I both have PTSD from living with her. And we talk about it each week. We have a little section where we talk about mom each weekend. And there's some confusion. There's some stuff we're still sorting out. It's going to be 7 years and we're still kind of working through it.
Yeah, absolutely. I try to make, you know, there are people out there who didn't forgive me, you know? And so, but there are a lot of people who did forgive me, but it just shows like, I just, how important, you know, support is for people and trying to find alternative treatments and things that work for people and have more services. And
I think I'm glad you said that, because something I thought about actually prior to tonight was my mother like had no support. Like I checked out from, I made decisions with her in the 90s. I had a big fight with her on the phone. And I said, if you want to call and yell at me, you can call and yell at somebody else. If you want to call and ask for, you know, for me to listen or something, I totally will. She got all pissed off about that. She was mad about it until she died. I'm the one person that like told her that she needed to, you know, behave. Mm-hmm. But like looking back, especially with what you just said, like how strong do you have to be? She was 70. She made it to 70 without any modern care. She had one person to support her, my father, who was like half in, right? I mean, how that must just wear you out, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was having a conversation today with a friend who I said they're going to be coming for me, like our government, like they're going to come round up all the mentally ill people. Like it's a maudlin joke. It's bad, I know, but I was having a day of it today. So I lost, yeah, but that she's like, yeah, but mental health is so much more improved, you know, like it's not like people are locked up in asylums and chained to the wall. I'm like, no, they're dying on the street.
No, I know. My mother was so, people come up to me. So I'm a magnet. If someone's in trouble, it could be on the subway or just, this has been going on since I was a child. People just run to me. Like if a person needs help, I'm like the first one they see. I don't know what it is. Well, I do know what it is. So I didn't realize how bad off my mother was until I got older. And I rarely see someone that is worse than her.
Wow.
Like there's people that are louder. There's people that are, you know, hurting people, like, you know, criminally attacking, which my mother didn't do that, but was kind of a little bit, but like, I know the depth of her pain and what she was trying to manage to get through every day. I haven't met anyone hardly that is worse than that. So I guess it's kind of a blessing. Like you, what you just said, like, I feel I've done more with her life since she died than I did before it. Like I've raised money in her name. I set up a fund at a theater company that I'm very close to. I'm writing the show that's almost ready to go. We're having this podcast together. More people know about my mother's story than ever knew her in her whole life. Like there's just thousands of people who know who she is. And if every single person would do that with whatever story has impacted them, I mean, that's gotta be good, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Anything that's weighing on you enough to be on your mind constantly is something that you can probably shape into some format to share with other people who would relate to it. I think that all the time with music or movies or stories. I mean, we all have issues with parents. And so I think that somebody who isn't in this particular situation listens to the story and says, oh yeah, like my parent was similar in this way and that way. And it's very relatable in some ways. And in other ways, like something that's hard to imagine too, you know?
Yeah,
you do a great job of finding the universality in it. When I first started writing about my mental health, like coming out about it, I was like, but what's the universal truth behind this? Okay, so this happened, but what are people supposed to glean from this, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and like you really, really do it well in your story.
Thank you. You know, I think you two will totally agree with me. Her love for me was so fierce, but I had to go find it. It wasn't given to me. I'm so glad I brought that. We're talking about this. So people have asked me for years. Actually, I was quiet about a lot of this for many years. And when she died, people were like, oh, I'm like, I know, I never told anybody about it. They said, well, she must have not loved you. And this is something that pisses me off, because just because she's mentally ill doesn't mean she doesn't love her kid. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you're mentally ill. Oh, they're gone. They're in mentally ill land. I'm like, no. I said, she loved me fiercely. I mean, we didn't stop talking. We emailed. It's not like I was estranged from my mother. But sorry, I had a larger point I was trying to make. So when she died, I couldn't find a single suicide note written to me. They were all written to my dad. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, I was really pissed off. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm your child. I'm your child. I'm saying this at like, you know, 46, 47. I'm like, where's the note to me? Don't I get one? I mean, this is terrible. So I find one. It's at the bottom of this huge pile. And it says, dear Sean, I hope you have a happy and long life. My decision has nothing to do with you. And I only found this by chance. I may have never found it. It could have been thrown out with a bunch of stuff, but we dug and dug and dug and dug and I found it. And it literally was an echo of when I was seven and she told me she was going to take her life someday. And it made me so happy to find it, because it affirmed what I knew, is that just because she was buried in these multiple personalities or whatever was going on, she never stopped loving me. And I think that's where I write from. So I can say all sorts of things, and I will. There's, you know, there's some horrible things she did, and I'll put them out there. But I will never, to both your, what you're picking up on, I will never cut my mother's love out of the story just because she was mean to me or living with mental illness. I mean, right?
That's right.
No, that comes out a lot.
Yeah. Well, I feel like this is going to be so helpful for so many people to listen to and to get to experience your wonderful, moving, important story. And I thank you for all the work you do in your mother's name to help break the stigma and raise awareness that people with mental illness are human beings. They can love, they experience loss, mm-hmm. they have a greatness within them. Mm-hmm. We need better support out there to support the families and to support the person who's sick and not point the finger at somebody who's suffering, like you haven't pointed the finger at your mother.
Yeah, I've tried not to. It happens.
It happens. No one's perfect.
But in the show I'm writing, I ultimately point it back to myself. The piece I wrote today, I sort of write about the last time I saw her, which was in 2006. And at the moment I leave the story, I won't go the whole thing, but this little story, piece of it, I basically say to my dad, who's like, I'm like, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. Cause she doesn't want to see me anymore. She's done. But it was kind of like this other personality took over, which I put in the story. So, but I put a postscript in a little story there and I say, well, I'm 30 something at the time. And I feel like I'm indestructible and always going to be 30 something. And my parents will always be there for me. So I put it on myself that I'm not wise enough to see the gravity of the situation. So we're both storytellers. So I put the backpack on myself, right? And you know this. So I can point at her, but ultimately it's me. I'm like, I wasn't woke enough, right? to like see her pain.
And oh my God, I was thinking today, like about my father, and I was so pointing the finger at him, and there's a lot to point the finger at him for, but ultimately I feel like I try, and what I see in your work and know of you as a person, that you know that it's futile at the end of the day, right? Like it doesn't really empower us to, it's exhausting too, right? Like it's just exhausting. Anger or point, blame, all that stuff. It is what it happened. And then, we embrace the trauma, I guess, because it's a lot of trauma too. Anyway, Bob,
No, you're right. Okay. Well, thank you for providing this. This has been amazing. And I wasn't quite sure how I was going to approach her tonight. And by the way, today's her birthday. So
really? Wow.
Yeah. It just worked out that way.
Well, so. It made sense for us to reschedule previously and end up recording on this day specifically.
Yep.
She would feel so honored. She does feel, maybe she does, in the vast universe. I like to believe there's some kind of infinity.
Yeah, where we all stand on afterlife and universal knowledge. When people die, do they just become part of everything, in which case
we need 6 more hours.
Yeah, we do. My parents are both atheists, Catholics, so they're what's done is done. But I do agree with you. I think it's that, you know, last person that says your name, you know, you're alive until that happens. I will say this, the amount of people that have reached out to me because they were fascinated by my mother. They were just fascinated. And I think it's because it's this firsthand account of living with someone who's really ill. Like there was not a lot of fun. And I mean, she was ill through and through. She didn't flirt with it. I mean, she would just cry all day. It was just terrible. So I've actually held back even from this, from some stuff I won't share because it's inappropriate. But the level of pain and the being able to find some light in it is really all we can do, which I think you're doing that in this podcast.
Why, thank you very much.
And you did that. Welcome. You did that in the story quite a bit. I mean, you would touch on aspects that were definitely dark spots, but you wouldn't dwell on them, and it would move on to something, I guess, that you learned from it.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to, I look forward to, and I know Scott too, to see the longer version. How fantastic.
Yay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're signing off.
Okay.
You can, Scott's going to stop record. Oh, Scott.
I'll say thank you so much for joining us, Sean.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here. And I look forward to more of your podcasts. Keep doing the good work.
Thanks, Sean.
And that's probably where we'll cut it.
Yeah, without what I was saying. I'm so bad at goodbyes. What?
Are you? No, you should go ahead and do a tag on.
But now I'm so, I always know, like, even if I have like a perfect date, I will be so bizarre when I say goodbye. And I feel like they liked me until that moment. And any situation, podcast dates, job interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Goodbyes are just awkward.
Yeah. Like, you know,
this will be the way you remember me.
Right. Like this forever.
Thank you so much for listening. Next episode, we're excited to have Jen Curcio with us.
Till then, let's keep talking about mental health and take a step forward as a society.